From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Calls for police reform are growing louder in Minnesota after the police killing of Daunte Wright. The officer who fatally shot Wright during a traffic stop on Sunday has resigned, as has the Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police chief. The state's Democratic governor is calling on lawmakers to pass police reforms that have stalled since the death of George Floyd last year. State Senator Omar Fateh represents the South Minneapolis district where Floyd was killed. He's a member of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, and he joins me now for more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I want to talk with you about police reform efforts. But first, just give us a sense of the mood of your constituents in Minneapolis today.
A lot of folks are really upset with Derek Chauvin being on trial. A lot of people were really stressed out, really still traumatized about what happened last year. And then we had this happen where a young 20-year-old, who was also a father, was murdered by a police officer. The city was already on the edge. And a lot of folks are really, really upset because we haven't done anything meaningful at the state level that could have prevented this murder.
Well, let's talk about that, Senator. You've said until we fundamentally upend and change the system, this needless state murder of Minnesotans, especially Black and Brown Minnesotans, is going to keep happening again and again and again. What reforms are you proposing, with the police reforms being debated now in the state house, actually go far enough?
Yes. So there's multiple proposals in the House right now that has actually had hearings and passed through committee. But in the Senate side, unfortunately, we haven't had one Senate hearing on any police accountability measures, any police accountability bills. So last year, there was a legislation that was passed that was agreed upon by both Democrats and Republicans. Folks were told that this would just be a start and we'd continue these conversations and make sure that we act with a sense of urgency this year or in this session. And that just hasn't happened. There has been no discussions. There has been no sense of urgency. We have been trying our best to get hearings on the bills that we have been introducing.
Quick question on those bills that are currently up. I mean, police say the Brooklyn Center officer who fatally shot Daunte Wright confused her gun for a taser. Is there anything in the reforms being debated now that would address a situation like that?
I think there's measures around training, but that's just something that has been a systemic issue going on for a long time. That officer has been on the force for, I believe, 25, 26 years, right? So this was a well-trained officer. The gun is supposed to be on your dominant side, as I understand, while the taser is on the other side. And a gun is heavier. So I don't really buy the idea that it was a mistake. And number two, even if it was a mistake, the actions didn't warrant the young man being tasered, person being pulled over for a simple traffic violation, and he ended up dying. Police are acting too aggressively, specifically with people of color. And I'm of the belief that had it not been a young Black man, that situation would not have occurred.
You know, last year, as we've been talking about, lawmakers passed measures restricting the use of chokeholds and neck restraints, and raising the legal threshold on when officers can use deadly force, among other things. That was framed as a first step in a broader conversation about police reform. But state Republicans have called more recent proposals an anti-law enforcement agenda. What do you say to that?
Number one, in regards to the chokeholds, that was one thing that was agreed upon by both Democrats and Republicans. And if I remember correctly, the language was modified to include, except with the exception of when officers feel that their life is threatened. But the argument is that officers always feel that their lives are threatened, which is why this is continuing to happen. So I think that itself did not go far enough. Number two, whether you're of the mind that is anti-law enforcement, we have to think, well, in that case, are you going to be anti-Black lives? Are you going to be anti-people of color? Because we're the ones that are suffering right now. We're the ones that are being murdered. Why is there no sense of urgency to protect them, to preserve that life? It would be a travesty for us to walk away from this session without doing anything.
Of course, this is happening during the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with murdering George Floyd. The defense is presenting its case now. You represent the district in South Minneapolis where Floyd was killed. We're all watching this trial. I know that you mentioned how people are angry in Minneapolis. What is your message, not only for your constituents, but the nation, as we watch this trial?
Well, I think it's okay to grieve, and I fully support the protesters who have been peaceful, by the way, in our district. People went up to Brooklyn Center to show solidarity for Dante Wright and his family, which is the right thing to do. So it's just not a Minneapolis thing. It's a Minnesota thing. It's a nation thing. And I think that the world is watching, and we need to act right now.
Minnesota State Senator Omar Fateh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, President Biden will visit Arlington National Cemetery this afternoon to pay his respects to Americans killed in the war in Afghanistan. Some of the nearly 2,400 service members who died are buried in Section 60. The trip will follow Biden's announcement that he'll pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th this year. That would be the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, which were launched by al-Qaeda from Afghanistan as Osama bin Laden sheltered there. Robin Wright has covered this war from every angle. She's a writer for The New Yorker. She joins us now. And Robin, we spoke to you 20 years ago. And now a lot of people are probably thinking about the blood and treasure, the lives lost, the money, $2 trillion spent. You write that this last phase, the pullout, could be the most confounding. What do you think about Biden's plan?
Well, Americans clearly want to withdraw all American troops from the Middle East. Policymakers and the American public understand that in the 21st century, China is the great challenge. Four presidents of this century have tried to pivot to Asia and have been unable to do so because they've been sucked into the conflicts in the Middle East and South Asia. This, I think, will probably be a popular move today. The question is, how will history view the United States walking away from its longest war without resolution and with the enemy, the Taliban, holding 50% of the country and probably afterwards taking over most of it?
Senator Jeanne Shaheen, the Democrat from New Hampshire, issued this statement. I'm very disappointed in the president's decision to set a September deadline to walk away from Afghanistan. Although it was made in coordination with our allies, the U.S. has sacrificed too much to bring stability to Afghanistan to leave without verifiable assurances of a secure future. And we are hearing about, you know, the Taliban having strongholds. You say he could be the president who finally extricates America from a quagmire, or a leader who cedes ground to jihadists. At least in Afghanistan, the Taliban does seem to have control.
And of course, one of the big questions is, will the United States have to go back? The United States withdrew during the Obama administration in 2011 from Iraq and had to go back after the emergence of ISIS. The same thing happened in Lebanon in the early 1980s when Marine peacekeepers withdrew and had to return just days later because of a massacre of more than 800, largely women and children. So the question is, when you don't complete a military mission or a political mission, do you have to go back? And of course, Americans hope that there is some kind of peace agreement between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The problem is the two sides are very far apart. The Afghan government is very weak. The Taliban is strong militarily and frankly believes that it has won. Just as Afghan militants believe they pushed the Soviet Union out, they now think they've done that with the Americans.
Do you worry, as Senator Shaheen does, in particular about women in Afghanistan?
Enormously. I was in Afghanistan last month, and it's very worrisome. We've invested a lot, not just in terms of our national treasure and American lives, but we've also invested in the development of a civil society, the encouragement of women to be part of the political and social environments, the economic environment too, to be part of politics. And we've made enormous headway with the help of a lot of non-government organizations. And the question is not just the withdrawal of American troops, or even more, the 20,000 NATO troops who are there, 10,000 NATO troops, excuse me, and 20,000 contractors, the non-government organizations that have been there to foster the kind of peaceful environment. Will they want to stay, be able to stay, given the unstable security environment? Afghanistan has not made the final transition. There's a haunting scene, Robin, at the end of Charlie Wilson's War, which is a wonderful movie about the last time we were engaged in Afghanistan or helping forces in Afghanistan fight the Soviet Union, when, after the Soviets withdrew, a congressman named Charlie Wilson tried to get funds to help for education. The United States had spent billions in trying to get the Soviets out. All he wanted was $1 million for education. And the chilling scene at the very end of the movie is when a congressman says, "Oh, no one cares about Pakistan." And Charlie Wilson has to say plaintively, "Afghanistan." And the danger is that we walk away, not just in terms of our military support, but that we forget that we made a commitment to support Afghanistan as a non-NATO major ally. And the danger is that there's no one left behind to help foster a peaceful Afghanistan.
New Yorker writer Robin Wright will link you to her article, "Why It's So Hard for America to End Its Wars," at hearnow.org. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Is Robert Duvall the greatest American actor? He tops a lot of lists, and we want to remind ourselves why. Starting with a role in which he didn't say a word, close your eyes. You can probably see this moment when Scout sees Duvall's Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Hey, Boo.
Miss Jean Louise, Mr. Arthur Radley.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb? For 12 hours, when it was all over, I walked up.
And if you just hold the ladder, baby, I'll climb to the top.
Now, besides the whiskey, I think we'll require a little respect. Now, I'm Captain Augustus McCrae. This is Captain Woodrow F. Call.
You may not have the privilege of serving under the meanest, toughest, screaming squadron commander in the Marine Corps. Me.
Mr. Corleone is a man who insists on hearing bad news immediately.
Robert Duvall as lawyer Tom Hagen in The Godfather. Before that, Bull Meacham in The Great Santini. Cattle driver Gus McCrae in Lonesome Dove. Country singer Max Sledge in Tender Mercies, for which he won an Oscar. And Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore in Apocalypse Now. Robert Duvall turned 90 this year, and we thought, what a good time to just say hi. A warning, it's always a bit of a family reunion. He was married to my sister at one time. Bobby Duvall, hello.
How you doing, Robin? How are you?
It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah.
What do you think, Bobby, when you hear lists like this?
It's nice to hear that some of the ones that are left out, especially the left out.
Is there one that may be left out that you actually think was overlooked?
Well, when I played Stalin, that was one of my favorite parts. It was very strange to be filming in the Kremlin, still with some of those leftover people that were probably pro-Stalin, you know. Maybe the greatest review I ever got, I feel, the Nikita Mikhailkov's father was like Stalin's personal poet. And when he saw the movie, he said, "I touched the soul of Stalin."
So, Koba?
No. Stalin.
Stalin?
My new name.
Steel.
Steel. But for you, friend to friends and comrades like you, I'm always Koba.
To Stalin.
No. To Lenin.
Well, some people say Stalin didn't have a soul, but I think you mean in every character you want to find one.
Yeah.
Yeah. The great American writer Larry McMurtry just passed, as you know, 84.
Yeah, he passed away recently.
Yeah. He, of course, wrote Lonesome Dove. You starred in the television adaptation with Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, that was probably my favorite part. And it was because of your sister that I went after it. And she was the one that told me to hone in on that part, not the other one. In Texas, it's like a religion. My good friend Hank Whitman, who was the head of the Texas Rangers, made me an honorary Texan, an honorary Texas Ranger. And a woman came up that day and said, "We watch Lonesome Dove once a year every in our Texas family." And she said, "I would not allow my daughter's fiancé to marry into the family until he had seen Lonesome Dove." So that's pretty much of a religious thing in the state of Texas, Lonesome Dove.
My sister was your then wife, the wonderful Gail Youngs. read the book, Lonesome Dove, told her you have to do this.
She said, I read a book I like better than Dostoevsky. And she said, you have to, you know. So my agent, I said, if you can get him to switch parts, then fine, but not otherwise, I'm not interested.
Why?
I don't know. It's just something, you know, you connect with, you know. That's what it was a feeling, you know. I went south with Rodney Jenkins, the great American horseman. I always believe I do my own horsemanship, my own singing, and my own dancing in a movie. It's me that has to do that.
Well, you worked with other great writers, Horton Foote, directors, Francis Ford Coppola in Apocalypse Now. Talk about Coppola. We asked listeners to send in questions for you, and I can't tell you how many wanted to know, where did the line about napalm come from?
That was Coppola. That was scripted, yeah. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory. I asked Francis, I only asked you one time, I'd like to play that part. And when I got there, the part was overwritten with a guy who was like a cowboy with boots. And it was a caricature. It was first written as a character called Colonel Carnage. So I got with a guy who had been in Vietnam, and he told me how to shape it with the air cavalry. Because I had been in the service in the Army, and I knew what those special service officers were like. We went from there and formed that, and Coppola gave me the chance to play that part.
We talked about roles that you obviously loved. By the way, do you just shake them off?
You try not to live in the past, but you can't help but doing that some.
I'm thinking of the Apostle.
Give it to me tonight, Lord God Jehovah. If you won't give me back my wife, give me peace. Give it to me, give it to me, give it to me, give me peace. Give me peace.
That was an interesting thing because I studied preachers all over America. And the greatest preacher I ever met was Isham Williams, an elderly black preacher from Hamilton, Virginia.
I remember I was privileged to travel with you and, again, your then wife, Gail. We went to visit with Johnny and June Carter Cash, and there was a little chapel down the road from them where the pastor worked with snakes. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Johnny was a religious man. Good person, Johnny Cash. And I remember one day he got caught behind a fence with his big longhorn steer, and June went crazy because the thing looked like it was going to charge him, but it didn't, you know.
Are you still Christian Scientist?
Yes.
Yeah. So why were these many fire and brimstone preachers so interesting to you?
Well, it's like a truly American art form. Mm. And I sent a copy of the film to Marlon Brando, and he sent me back a note. It was wonderful. He accepted it. And then I also heard that Billy Graham accepted the film. So I got it from the secular, and I got it from the religious community both. And I have this letter on the wall from Brando. I like it more than my Oscar.
What was it like to work with Marlon Brando? Were you and Al Pacino and others tiptoeing around him a little bit? Or?
Yeah, a little bit in the beginning. You know, Jimmy Conn, he's one of a kind, Jimmy. Great guy. He'd crack a joke and it'd take Brando 3 seconds to get it. You know, he was like the godfather of actors. Dustin Hoffman, me and Gene Hackman used to go to Cromwell Drugstore a couple of times a week in New York City. And if we mentioned Marlon once, we mentioned him 25 times.
Why?
Well, he was very innovative, the guy. You know, he was novel. And when I first saw him, I got not threatened, but I said, I don't understand what he's doing. He was so real, you know. And then we got to work with him. It was wonderful, you know. Very special guy.
I think you should tell your Don what everyone seems to know.
I didn't tell Mama anything. I was about to come up and wake you just now and tell you.
But you needed a drink first.
Yeah.
And now you've had your drink.
They shot Sonny on the causeway. He's dead.
Is that it, Bobby, being real? I mean, what would you say? When do you know you're doing it right and well?
Well, it kicks in. Things kick in. Like somebody said once, there's no right and wrong. There's only truthful and untruthful, so to speak.
Yeah. I have some more questions from listeners, and one of them is going to be, who was the best teacher you ever had? I was thinking of Sanford Meisner.
Meisner, yeah, he was good, but he dealt with the imaginary, but I also think you can drift from that and use anything you want to use.
What do you mean he dealt with the imaginary?
You know, it's as if this, and use the imaginary. But I believe you can use anything. You can go beyond that and use the personal anytime you want to use it.
What would your advice be to a young actor starting out?
Get with some kind of group. Don't be isolated individually, you know. Recently, on my birthday, my wife, she had all different people call in. And Dustin Hoffman, he said that I took my social life lightly, but my career more heavily. I am kept in touch with too many of those guys from The Godfather, De Niro and those guys. And they're all, everybody's dying.
Well, yeah. That's what you get for living a long, wonderful life. You know, it's.
Yeah.
But that's got to feel good to be in that number, to be in that.
Yeah, but they will always be good actors. I feel that the work done now ensemble-wise is better than before.
Really?
It goes on and on and on and on. I always say, you know, come into the fold.
Well, you could do a movie with Robert Duvall.
You know, there's a few more left, maybe.
Well, Bobby, I just, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Do you still get up in the morning and go, Mighty?
All my friends talk about Mighty. That started with my brother way back, my older brother. He liked Michigan, so he used to talk about Mighty Michigan's football team. Yeah.
Well, this was just Mighty. It's the day, and we all felt we had to seize it with you.
Mighty to see you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
United Airlines has announced plans to team up with companies from around the world to purchase cleaner fuels. The goal is to help offset emissions, but as climate change worsens, environmental advocates warn that initiatives like this might fall short. Here now is transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
Yeah, first of all, tell us, what is this? They're calling it sustainable aviation fuel. So what is it? And talk about how United is going to further incorporate it into its business.
Well, broadly, these are fuels, Robin, that are not your traditional fuels. You're not traditional petroleum-based fuels. So it could be turning municipal waste into fuel, for example. It could be something that's grown. But for it to be sustainable, and here's the rub, it has to be something that truly, over its life cycle, as environmentalists would say, is sustainable. So, you know, if you're growing it on farmland and displacing food that would feed people, that's not sustainable. Maybe if you're growing algae, that's growing somewhere where you wouldn't otherwise be growing food, that could be. And so that's really the question here. And there's disagreement over what exactly is sustainable. But what's clearly not sustainable in the eyes of anybody who's trying to define this is the current traditional jet fuel, which makes up well more than 99% of the fuel consumed by airlines today.
Right. It's been such a conundrum. You know, what do we do about flying? But what about the cost? The cleaner fuels that pass those tests of being sustainable, how much do they cost compared to traditional jet fuel?
They're far more expensive. United said, related to this announcement, 2 to 4 times as much as traditional fuels. And two, right now, Robin, double the cost would be optimistic. And that's if you could even produce it at the scale that you would need, which right now it's just not there. That's kind of part of the point of why it's so expensive. So when you think about what every dollar in crude oil prices means to airlines, the way it moves their profits up or down, or right now their losses up or down, right? It's all about shrinking losses. That right now is rather expensive.
Well, but what about people who say that this whole thing is just a publicity stunt? Does United have skin in the game here?
Well, United CEO Scott Kirby went out of his way to say, so anticipating that kind of pushback, this is not just words, he said. This is not just marketing. But look, United's being very vocal about this. They're saying we're putting actual money into this, although a lot of this, Robin, the details here is that they're asking some of the people who fly them to help cover part of the cost of the more expensive fuel, and also lobbying. So basically using political capital that ostensibly they could be using for something else to get something else they want, to ask politicians to make the rules such that basically it makes sense for them and other companies to do this.
Yeah, and United says they want to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 100% by 2050. So they seem to be actively working towards that. Just a couple seconds here. You know, there is a business case for this for airlines, right?
There is. I mean, there are people, first of all, who want to support companies doing these kinds of things. And so, that part of the flying community, which is not a majority, right? Most people are looking at price and schedule when they pick an airline. But more and more people are paying attention. And so United's kind of trying to get ahead of that, be on the right side of history.
Seth Kaplan here, now's transportation analyst. Seth, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
As we watch the events unfold in Minnesota, our next guest notes, during the course of American history, we've been in this place many times before, watching the excessive use of violence against Black, brown, and poor people with little to no action toward real change or reform. Imani Perry says it's important to bring these conversations of the past into the present as activists and political leaders take on this idea of police reform. Perry is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. You pointed out in a tweet recently that if we look at Black newspapers in the early 20th century, there was ongoing discussion then about problems with policing. Literally, we've been having this discussion for more than 100 years, watching, as you write, the authority of the state killing people without any process. With this historical context in mind, it's almost as if we're acting out the same roles over and over again.
Right. I mean, I in some ways we are. I think in some ways, though, it's become even more egregious. So it used to be the case that a particular incident of police brutality might lead to a protest. We're not responding to brutality. We're responding to killings. Summary execution, no due process, no presumption of innocence, no equal protection under the law. There are lots of young people. I mean, in some ways it feels as though there's something both absurd as well as, of course, tragic, because we continue to be encouraged to invest in the status quo. There's talk about reestablishing trust, but there is a fundamentally untrustworthy institution that has not reformed itself since, literally for generations. And it's incredibly frustrating to imagine that, yes, 100 years later, we're still talking about this institution in this way.
Elsewhere in the program, I had a conversation with Minnesota State Senator Omar Fateh, and he says until we fundamentally upend and change this system, this needless state murder of Minnesotans, specifically, especially Black and brown Minnesotans, is going to keep happening over and over and over. This is kind of your point. Police reform is on the table, though, in state legislatures in ways we haven't seen before. This is all happening at the same time. How do these developments square with history, and are you hopeful?
This is what I'm hopeful about. I am hopeful that there is a conversation that extends beyond reform, that's raising really fundamental questions about whether or not police officers ought to be carrying guns, ought they be doing traffic stops, should they intervene in mental health crises. Obviously, they are not equipped to do those things. They don't have sufficient training. Clearly, the misuse of force is persistent. And we also know that there's been an infiltration of police departments by white supremacist organizations. So this idea that there must be a fundamental transformation, I think, is a good one. I'm glad that it's gained steam. I think there are lots, though, of political actors who are very resistant to what people are calling for. So I wouldn't say that I'm hopeful about the transformation in the near future, but I am extremely hopeful that people are really connecting the dots about not just how impunious and unjust often the behavior of police officers is, but raising questions about, you know, the necessity. We should not take that for granted, you know, that there should be police roaming around on our streets with guns.
Are you watching the Derek Chauvin trial?
I've watched bits and pieces. I want to keep abreast of what's happening. The moments where they show his murder are very difficult for me to watch. I did not watch it originally. It feels to me, honestly, inappropriate to watch someone being killed. And it's something that we almost only do with Black people in the society. But I am trying to follow the trial.
You know, it's interesting. You said it's something we only do with Black people. And at the same time, there's, you know, there's a swell of folks who want it to be shown, because what it's basically showing when you have video is to say, take a look at our humanity. Here, there is evidence to show that this has happened. But we see in history time and time again that that's really simply not enough. I mean, how do you grapple with that?
Yeah, I think it's not enough, but we also ought to be concerned about what the repetition of showing Black people being killed. There's an incredible risk of dehumanization and desensitization by the repeated cycle of seeing Black people killed. Lynching was a public event, right? We have a history in which Black death has not moved people, and there's a kind of, I think, absolute disregard for the most difficult moments of people's lives. And at this point, we've been seeing what are essentially snuff films of Black people for years. We've seen it over and over again, and we literally have no change. I mean, it's just that millions of people have taken to the streets.
To your point, Ben Crump, the attorney for the families of Dante Wright and George Floyd, has said that when it comes to policing, this is not a training issue or a policy issue, that essentially baked into the fiber of this country is that police don't treat Black American citizens the same as white citizens. This is what you're saying. This is the age-old
yes.
story of America in many ways. But do you think it's even possible for white people to see and truly understand? I mean, that is really the fundamental question here.
I do, and I want to say this. There is definitely racial injustice in policing, but there are also poor white communities that have lots of people experience abusive treatment from police officers. There are Latinx communities. There are queer communities that experience this. So I do think, one, that there are more people who have been wounded by excessive policing than we sometimes discuss. And so I think that's one sort of pathway to the understanding. But another is that, you know, you see millions of people, not all Black people by any means, all over the world, taking to the streets. So they've made a statement. And the question is, why does our political leadership, why do the powers that be refuse to respond to this very loud public dissent in so many places? So in some ways, when white people do understand, they are disciplined out of understanding because the structure of the society doesn't shift. So they have a moment of potential reckoning. But if nothing changes, it actually dissociates white Americans from our experience. Yeah, so I do think that there's a capacity. And I'm not saying that white people can understand what it's like to be Black. I think it's very hard to fully understand another person's identity, but absolutely they can understand the injustice.
With that, do you think there should be federal intervention? What would you like to see on the federal level on this topic of police reform?
So I have mixed feelings about this. Certainly in the abstract, there should be. But what the history of the 20th century taught us is that at various moments where at the presidential level, at the federal level, people said they were going to address problems associated with policing, really what they did is give more money to police departments, which really has led to greater impunity and, of course, the rise of mass incarceration. So the concept of reform, as it tends to be imagined at the federal level, actually is not punitive, is not a deterrent, and there will be lots of dollars spent examining. But unless you begin the process of defunding, dismantling, really, deterrence by structure, training, sensitivity training doesn't work, we know. We also know that even diversity, equity, and inclusion training doesn't show results in any kind of institution. So the question for me is, what kind of examination are they talking about? What I would like to see happen is actually at the state level, sort of legislators continuing to be responsive and accountable to local organizing branches. And on the other side, I think we have to be more innovative in how we pursue protest, because marches are clearly not functioning. We've had so many over the past 6 years or so, are not functioning to have produced the desired effect.
Imani Perry is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. Take good care.
Donald Trump brought more working-class voters into the Republican Party than any president since Ronald Reagan.
I'm the candidate of police officers, the middle class.
I gave working families record-setting tax cuts.
Blue-collar workers, they were the ones that had the biggest benefit.
Well, now Republicans are trying to figure out how to keep them, though working-class vote will be crucial in next year's midterms. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis has this report, which first aired on Morning Edition.
In the last decade, the biggest growth in the Republican coalition has been white voters without a college degree, along with some growth with similarly educated Black and Hispanic voters. That's why Republicans like Indiana Congressman Jim Banks believe the only winning path forward for the GOP is to fully reimagine itself as the party of the working class.
And if Republicans want to be successful as a party when the majority in 2022 went back to the White House, in 2024, I think we have to learn lessons that Donald Trump taught us and how to appeal to these voters.
Banks is the chairman of the Republican Study Committee, a conservative faction in the House long rooted in small government, low taxes, and social conservatism. He recently sent a 6-page memo to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, making the case that Republicans need to refocus their agenda almost entirely on working class appeals. For Banks, this means tougher immigration laws, cracking down on China, big tech, and perhaps most provocatively for Republicans, corporate America.
For too long, the Republican Party fed into the narrative that the Republican Party was the party of big business or the party of Wall Street.
Republicans are increasingly comfortable attacking corporations these days. That's a lot easier for them after Wall Street donors gave more to Joe Biden. Major companies halted political donations to Republicans who objected to Electoral College results on January 6th, and as companies take more liberal positions on controversial issues, like Georgia's new voting law. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell last week issued a rare verbal rebuke of companies that oppose the law.
My warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for.
Top Senate Republicans, some considering 2024 presidential runs, have been echoing the call to remake the party even before the 2020 election.
We've got a big battle in front of us, Republicans do, to try and make this party truly the party of working class America.
That's Missouri Senator Josh Hawley last November. He's among a group of Senate Republicans who's taken recent positions that run counter to longstanding party orthodoxy, like linking arms with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in support of stimulus checks last year, and supporting a $15 minimum wage for companies with annual revenues over $1 billion. Others include Florida's Marco Rubio, who recently sided with pro-union forces in an organizing dispute at Amazon, and Utah's Mitt Romney, who's introduced legislation to expand the welfare state to provide more generous benefits to combat child poverty. John Russo is a visiting scholar at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University and a co-editor of the publication Working Class Perspectives.
I think the claims that the Republican Party is the party of the working class is at best insincere and more likely political misdirection and rebranding exercises.
The working class vote is complicated, says Russo, and too often confused with whiteness, when about 40% of the working class vote is people of color. Their support also didn't cut overwhelmingly towards Republicans in 2020. Biden still won a majority of voters who earn less than $50,000 a year, while Trump won a majority of voters who earn over $100,000 a year. Russo says about a third of working class voters are considered persuadable in elections, and it's never reliable whether cultural or economic forces will drive their vote.
The working class, like all of us, carry multiple identities: race, class, gender, religious, geographic, and people may vote different parts of their identity as situation and moments change in their lives.
Democrats are not ceding this vote without a fight, led by a new president with a blue-collar upbringing all his own and who wants to enact the most radical economic investment in the working class since the New Deal, with a message to sell it targeted almost squarely at the working class vote.
I'm not trying to punish anybody, but damn it. Maybe it's because I come from a middle-class neighborhood. I'm sick and tired of ordinary people being fleeced.
Republicans think Democrats are overreaching. Banks compares Biden's economic plans to a feel-good sugar high that will lead to a crash.
Then when it bottoms out and American workers, blue-collar, working-class Americans feel the effect of it, they're going to blame Joe Biden and Democrats for it.
The battle for the working class is even more urgent because it's a growing block of voters. Since the 2008 financial crisis, Russo says, more middle-class people have slid economically backward and are experiencing what he calls, quote, the fragility of working class life. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
And passing the baton a little here this afternoon on All Things Considered, an update on a story we've been covering, the efforts in many states to limit transgender athletes from participating in sports. Florida is the latest state to consider a law requiring athletes to compete in school sports according to their sex at birth. We'll go to Florida today on All Things Considered. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.